Having taken out about half the Norm recruits in their counterattack, the Sticky swarmed closer to the survivors, stopping just out of blade reach. They cocked their bald heads this way and that. Four and five deep, they ringed the companions, waving their arms. Ryan guessed the number of Norms still able to put up a fight was close to 35. There were at least three times that many Stickies jumping around the bowl.
Oh, shit! Not again!
Here comes another wave!
Over the tops of the bobbing bald heads, Ryan saw Magus' second wave make its exit from the cone. Swampies marched in, four abreast and maybe 10 deep. He could smell them coming, even over all the spilled blood and guts. The stumpy little men waved wooden clubs studded with long steel spikes, short-handled battle axes, and half-sized broadswords. The ankle biter's favorite tactic was to cut for the legs, bringing their foes down to size. Revenge on a too-tall world. Following the swampies out the doors and towering over them were 15 or 20 scalies. They waddled forward in a ragged single-file line, males and females naked to the waist. They carried no weapons. Scalies were not a particularly courageous species, except when hungry.
I see scalies! They look hungry!
The scattered clumps of recruits closer to the cone were the first to feel the sting of the combined muti force. Stickies and swampies rushed them in unison. It was a high-low affair. The Norms fighting Stickies left their lower bodies unprotected. The swampies cut hamstrings with their axes and swords and shattered kneecaps with their spiked clubs. The Norms trying to beat back the Swampies had to bend over to reach them, which allowed Stickies to leap onto their unprotected backs. The small bands of recruits lasted a minute or two before being penetrated and overrun. Their job completed, the Swampies moved on, all business. The sour-faced muties didn't eat human flesh, perhaps because they themselves were too close to human genetically, or too smart. The Swampies didn't look smart with those heavy brows and block-shaped heads, but they were a crafty race. They knew the flesh of some man had a hellblast to turn your brains into goo taint, and avoided partaking of it. The Scalies waddled onto the scene seconds after the Swampies. They moved through the heaps of wounded with their little pig eyes alight, like it was an all-you-can-eat buffet. Squatting, they started pulling off warm snacks, snapping spines, and sucking out the living marrow. Ryan could see the handwriting on the wall. The companions couldn't hold out for long against a joint muti attack. It was a matter of reach and sheer numbers. If one of the group went down, the formation would be broken, and they would all go down. The Swampies marched toward the companions, shaking their bloody weapons in the air.
You ready, lover?
We don't have any choice. Egg!
How are you holding up?
We've got to hook up if we're going to make it through this!
Sounds like a plan! Girls rights, men!
The two groups of fighters merged and blended together, shoulder to shoulder, facing outward, forming a larger and stronger defensive ring.
Well, you have a plan?
Your men's sabers are longer. Keep the Swampies from getting close enough to attack.
So keep the blades low, huh?
Yeah. That should give us the freedom to take out the Stickies and the Scalies. Here they come. Swords front!
The Swampies, who couldn't control themselves, will run through. Their blood joining the mess of offal on the ground.
We got more Stickies, cut!
As they had done before, the Stickies leapt onto the Norm fighters, but with no exposed backs to take advantage of, they ended up falling on sword points, skewing themselves to the hilt. Their feet a yard off the ground, they squirmed like worms on a hook. Captain Aang had his own savage technique for disengaging a skewered enemy. One was still flailing on his blade, and Aang broke down with his shoulder, leaning on the handle with both hands. The Sticky's feet slammed to the rock, but the saber had just kept going. The muti fell to the ground, the saber nowhere near him, its pelvis cleaved in two. Ryan used his blade point and edge to hack down the pale creatures that threw themselves at him. As she had done before, Mildred handled the Stickies with ease, but she couldn't cut Swampy's throats in the same fashion. They were too short for a clean strike, and their long chins and matted steel-wool beards protected their Adam's apples from her blade's edge. In addition, their necks were too stumpy for her to get a good angle on the sides. When she tried slicing downward to sever the carotids and jugulars, she ended up chopping through their collarbones, which only disabled them on one side, and made them very angry. Mildred had to let the Islander bookends deal with the ankle biters and concentrate on the Stickies. One of the smaller Swampies ducked under the slash of the cavalry sword and, side-hopping 2 feet to the right, rushed at Mildred's legs with a cocked-back battle axe. Before it could swing at her shins, she swept the point of her bayonet down, then up, driving hard, skewering the attacker and lifting it from the ground. The axe dropped out of its too large, too hairy hand. A blade thrust clear through its chest. The ugly little creature bared its mossy green teeth. It reminded her of something out of Snow White, only Snow White on Jolt. Mildred gripped the knife with both hands, braced her legs, and extended her arm so it couldn't claw her face and eyes. The islander to Mildred's left reached over and grabbed the mutie by a shoulder, and with a snap of his arm gave it a spin on the blade. The swampy pinwheeled around the hilt of bayonet, its arms and legs outstretched. When it stopped spinning, it was both limp and silent. Mildred flung the corpse over the heads of the oncoming stickies. She didn't see where it landed. Around the perimeter of the circle, the muties were either killed or turned back. Not one of them made it through the known lines alive. Despite being outnumbered, the companions and islanders had held their own and turned back the muties' initial charge.
We're not done yet, men!
When the swampies retreated a little to regroup, the stickies pulled back as well. Behind them, the scalies waited in the wings, mountains of flabs sitting on cushions of the dead, conserving their energy. The pendulous, drooping folds of their skin gave off an iridescent sheen. Their expressions were alert, expectant. They weren't satisfied with what they had already eaten. They were never satisfied. There was always room for more. A half dozen of the swampies turned on one of the larger scalies, a 500-pound bull. They surrounded it and began to prod it with their weapons. The seated behemoth tried to swat them away, but they kept poking. The swampies continued until it rose to its feet and started lumbering toward the circled defenders. As it lumbered, it picked up speed, and all the swampies and many of the stickies fell in behind its vast bulk. The strategy was simple. Break through the ring with an unstoppable living battering ram, then attack and kill the Norms from two sides at once. The plan would have worked if it hadn't been for the Calcutta cavalry swords.
Let the scaly in!
As the captain stepped out of the way, so did Ryan. The circle opened, letting the scaly right in. Then it closed, slamming shut right behind the scaly. The swampies and stickies trying to ride on its coattails found themselves too close to sharp steel. Those that couldn't jump back were chopped down and stomped flat. The scaly had closed its eyes a split second before it made contact with the circle. After taking four strides forward, when there was no resistance, it stopped and opened its eyes. It looked around and saw it was surrounded and all alone. Four of Aang's crew turned away from the edge of the circle, which instantly closed ranks again. The four formed a second circle, this one around the stock-still scaly. The scaly raised a finger.
As you can see, I have no weapon. Those little swampy shits made me attack you. I had no choice. They would have killed me. Please, protect me from them. I mean you no harm.
The gore and bone marrow smeared across its cheeks and chins made the last statement suspect, to say the least.
You've been eating our men.
No, I was forced to!
The scaly instantly lost 30 pounds of excess weight from its backside. The clean slice exposed a thick rind of white fat and blood-red flesh beneath. Blows rained down from all sides. This was the islander diet. It made you thinner in a hurry, but it also made you dead.
That's one more down!
I swear, after this is over, I'm never going to want to hear this song again.
When Mildred first saw the skagworms coming at her, she thought she was imagining things. They looked like shadows flying across the ground as they slithered and snaked over the battlefield's scattered bodies and through the standing puddles of blood. Their domed, eyeless, antennaless heads reminded her of the business ends of red-eye anti-aircraft missiles. Their segmented armor backplates looked slick, like they'd been greased, and there were countless scrabbling yellow bug legs underneath. Scuttling at high speed, the worms weaved erratic trails through the dead to reach the living. One creature shot along the spine of a dead sticky and hurled itself at Mildred's foot.
Whoa!
If she'd had her ZKR 551 in her hand instead of the bayonet, she could have blasted it in the head end as it rushed by her. The bayonet was too slow, and the worm was running too low to reach, no more than 10 inches above ground. The skagworm crossed the ring, its thousand legs a blur, ran up an islander's leg, and bit him in his belly. Blue-black, horizontal jaw snapping, it ate and scrabbled and twisted into his torso. He backed into the middle of the ring, clutching at his bare stomach with both hands. The man was shivering head to foot, every tendon clenched, like he was about to shake apart.
Captain Aang stepped forward and slashed down with his sword.
Yeah!
The blade bounced off the creature's back without cutting. The shell didn't even dent. The mutie squirmed through the islander's white-knuckled grip, disappearing into his torso. Under the circumstances, there was only one way the man could be helped. Aang lifted the sailor's thick black braid out of the way and swung his saber. Other black shadows shot from among the dead, and suddenly the worms had their hands full. There weren't that many of the worms, but trying to chop them up with swords and tomahawks was more challenging than it looked, thanks to the mutants' rapid sinuous movement and their slick armored shells. The norms fended them off with blows to the head, but they couldn't seem to kill them. The swampy, stickies, and scalies watched the unfolding chaos, but didn't join in. They were waiting for something else to happen.
What the hell does it sound?
Flies?
Yeah, a whole shitload. Look up!
Looking up, the group saw a widely dispersed cloud of flying insects. As the bugs swirled around and around, they flew closer and closer together until they were a churning black mass that instilled fear and dread in the stickies and swampies. They backed up in a hurry. Even the scalies got off their butts. The cloud of insects zeroed in on two islanders standing shoulder to shoulder. The set-upon crewmen tried to beat the bugs out of the air with the flats of their swords, to no avail. The swarming flies landed all over their heads and tattooed torsos. Then they started stinging. The crewmen slapped themselves, squashing the insects with the flats of their hands. But the stinger's poison was already taking effect. Their flesh began to balloon up, eyelids squeezing shut, great angry welts popping out everywhere. The bugs clung doggedly to their skin, letting themselves be crushed rather than withdraw their pumping stingers. Blinded, the sailors staggered backward. They managed only a few steps before they fell to the ground. Unable to defend themselves, they were easy pickings for the skagworms, which honed in on their feeble struggles. Before any of the norms could intervene, the islanders' ribs were snapping between bolt-cutter jaws, and the 2-foot-long worms were boring into the dark warmth of their bellies. No one tried to end their torment. There wasn't time. A new hazard was almost on top of them. Moving much faster than the worms, and leaping in high, energetic bounds, was a pack of gray, hairy creatures. They were jumping like they were on springs. They were the size of a terrier dog, with a vicious set of fangs and a naked, rat-like tail. These rat muties leaped horizontal distances of 20 feet or more in a single bound. Mildred saw one go airborne much closer than that, and just had time to raise her bayonet point to catch it. She speared a fat 2-pounder through the middle. The true edge of the blade had clipped its spinal cord. Its back legs hung down limply. The front legs were going to beat the band. It had bulgy red eyes, shaggy mouse-gray fur tipped with yellow, and pointy ears. Though it was half-paralyzed, bleeding and crapping, its naked tail wrapped around the blade, it snapped its fangs, trying to get a piece of her. Edward slung her sword out. Down the perimeter, things weren't going nearly so well. Two rat devils were tearing out an islander's throat, while a third rode the back of his neck, trying to bite through into his brain.
Get up!
Ryan and JB tried to kill the things with Ponga and Tomahawk, but their blows never made contact. The little muties were too quick, and they could jump too far. The islander was beyond help, bleeding out from massive wounds to both sides of the neck. A rat devil had sunk its fangs into Captain Aang's thigh, just above the knee. The mutie was hanging on, shaking its head, trying to tear out a hunk of flesh. The islander reached down and snatched hold of the creature, squeezing on its neck until it opened its jaws. Aang then hoisted the rat devil up, and gritting his teeth, squeezed some more. The mutie's torso popped like a rotten tomato in his fist, turning to a bloody scrap of hair with legs. When another islander went down with a terminal case of skagworm, the stickies and swampies surged forward. With the norms reeling, the formation shaken, the time had come to close the deal.
Hold it! Hold it! Close ranks!
Mildred saw Ryan glance over his shoulder, back the way they had come. Something in his expression, a realization perhaps, made her look in that direction too. The path they'd forged from the rim of the dish led nowhere but the water's edge, and there the boats full of uniforms waited. The boats had drifted much closer to shore, perhaps so the passengers could get a better view of the show. They were within 40 feet of the beach, and all the oars were shipped. Men with auto rifles looked on the carnage and smiled toothlessly. There was no way to win, no place to retreat to, no way off the stinking rock. Even so, Mildred would not admit defeat. She was an optimist first and foremost. She believed that where there was a will to survive, there was a way to survive, especially in the company of courageous warriors. She knew she was getting tired, that her reactions were slowing down. The bayonet felt like it weighed 10 pounds. She didn't know how much longer she could effectively fight, but she clung to the belief that she could fight long enough to get through this. But when she saw the doors open again, her hope sputtered and failed.
So, we just sent out the rat devils. What's next? The screamies.
Things were going wrong, just the way Rish had hoped. A cohesive, seasoned fighting force was much, much more difficult to deal with than onesies or twosies. Not that the individual recruits were easy to kill. They died taking muties with them, which reduced the mutie numbers and increased the odds in favor of the organized norm units. It appeared that even the self-deluded King of Pomposity was beginning to see the scope of the problem. Rish got a warm feeling as he imagined Sylum trapped in the skybox with the likes of Magus, helplessly watching the disaster unravel, which spelled his own doom. The Screamies had only been released into combat once before, and that had been a limited field test. The consequences of that release gave everyone pause. Only the Enforcers and Magus himself could withstand their hypersonic attack. From the results of the test, it was clear that Norms and other muties had no chance against them. Turning the five wraiths loose on the islet was tantamount to admitting that things had gotten out of hand. Once they were released, they were uncontrollable, indiscriminate killers. The idea of losing all his muties in one fell swoop wouldn't sit well with Magus. There was the cost and the trouble of restocking his zoo, and of course, the lost time. If the Screamies failed to bring down the curtain on Carter and the Islanders, it would be up to the men in the boats, using their assault rifles on foes armed with blades and axes. It wasn't the kind of high-quality entertainment Magus sought. If it all came down to guns versus knives, Sylum might as well pick up a blade himself and cut his own throat. The question was, would he live long enough to cut Rish's throat first, the man he had relied on to edit his art, to fine-tune his inspiration? The Spin Doctor's Spin Doctor.
Why is he calling for the Screamies? What's going on out there?
I think Sylum may have miscalculated the resilience of some of the recruits. The afternoon show isn't going exactly as he planned. There's no time for questions, Jazzwinder. Not unless you want to die today. Come on, give me a hand and be quick about it.
With Jazzwinder on his heels, Rish trotted down the menagerie corridor to the Screamy cell. The five muties turned to look up at him as he reached on tiptoes for a stone shelf beside the door. From the shelf, he took two pairs of Bullseye Ultimate 10 hearing protectors and two pairs of Lexan wraparound goggles. It was the gear they used during feeding and periodic hose downs.
Here, put these on.
Right.
After he and Jazzwinder put on the muffs and goggles, Rish waved over the zoo's contingent of enforcers. When they opened the cell, the gagged and bound Screamies just glowered at them from the straw. Seeing the ear and eye protection, they didn't bother giving voice. They looked like five very unhappy teenage girls, though what they really were, Rish had no clue. They appeared to be related and the same age. They could have been multiple births, sisters, or even clones. The Screamies had just turned up in a cargo of muties, already bound and gagged, with written instructions on their care and handling. There were specific instructions on safety procedures, lethality ranges, and the like. Rish had heard the rumor that Magus had paid dearly for them, in wags and high-test fuel. At Rish's signal, the enforcers entered the cage, and gripping the girls by their upper arms, pulled them to their feet. The wraiths visibly recoiled at the creature's sweaty touch. Rish found himself looking up at them, and they looked down their pert noses at him, radiating contempt for the gnarly runt who had control of their destinies. The Screamies were a good head and a half taller than he was.
You're going to be good girls now. We're just going to let you out for some fresh air and a little choir practice.
Their pretty faces seethed with rage. He couldn't tell if they could understand him or not.
We're just going to go outside, okay?
But first, let's get this tape off your mouths.
The Norms stepped back as the Screamies pulled the wet, wadded rags from their mouths and threw them down onto the straw. Then, two things happened very quickly. It had all been planned, of course, while they'd sat bound in their cell. Rish could see that from their triumphant expressions, a plan worked out in eye movements, head nods, perhaps even mental telepathy. One of the screamies reached out and with a single swipe of her hand tore the earmuffs and goggles from Jazzwinder's head. All five of the muties opened their mouths, showing the black lining. Protected by headphones, Rish didn't actually hear the noise, but it hurt. It hurt like a steel bit drilling up through the roof of his mouth. The side of his body facing the muties was blasted by heat, like he had stepped too close to a bonfire. He tasted blood, but not his own. It was Jazzwinder's. Blood gushed from Jazzwinder's ears, eyes, and nose. Not in pulsing arterial jets, but fountaining like a busted water pipe. The skin of his bald head rose up in great watery blisters.
Stop them!
The screamies moved in and wreaked close-range devastation on what was left of Jazzwinder. Their assault cooked his brains like a microwave oven. Jazzwinder's eyeballs bulged, smoking. Then they burst apart. Brains bubbled out his emptied eye sockets like pink gravy. Rish could feel and smell their sweet breath on his face as they aimed a torrent of destruction at him. Despite the protection he was wearing, the drill bit spun faster, bored deeper, augured wider. Rish backed away as the enforcers grabbed them from behind and clapped hands over their open mouths and pert noses. The muties kicked wildly and tried to scratch the knobby skin. All they managed to do was break their nails. Slowly, their faces turned red, then purple, then they stopped struggling. Only when they went limp did the enforcers let them breathe through their noses. Rish looked down at Jazzwinder. His face was a bloody mess. Steam rolled out of his eye sockets and ears. Rish couldn't imagine what it had to have felt like to die that way. The building pressure and heat inside the skull, eyeballs bursting, the explosion of pain that was not a release, but a door opening to even greater agony. Jazzwinder hadn't deserved such a horrible death.
Let them go!
When the creatures obeyed, he saw that the pressure of their hands had left red marks on the milk-white skin and glistening smears of sweat. Despite himself, Rish was taken aback when the rays just stood there smiling, pleased that their affronted dignity had been revenged for the moment. They flipped their long braids over their shoulders with a practiced toss of the head. Again, the small, perfect noses went up in the air. The blue eyes flashed behind corn-silk lashes. Jazzwinder still lay in the straw, his brains seeping to the floor. Rish had the urge to order the enforcers to re-gag and rebind the screamies and send them out into battle. That way, the other loosed muti species would pull them apart. As powerful as the impulse was, he thought better of it. His hand could not be apparent in the disaster.
Get those bitches out of here!
Doc Tanner fought his way up a curving, narrow passage. While the steeply angled floor had substance, it looked like black marble. The walls and ceiling did not. They were smoke, impenetrable gray smoke that churned around and under the free-floating platform. It was like being inside the belly of a tornado. He touched the wall with his hand, and the smoke swallowed it up. The air appeared to be moving in a clockwise swirl. Above him was the strange passage's end. A single floor-mounted spotlight shone on a wooden door, thickly painted apple green. As he continued to climb toward that goal, the effort caused his legs and solar plexus to ache. Ignoring the pain, he put one unsteady foot in front of another. When Doc reached the barrier, he turned the knob. The door slammed back on its hinges from a powerful suction, sending Doc skidding in reverse. He had to drop to his knees and put his hands flat on the marble to keep from losing all the ground he had gained. The wind through the doorway was blowing directly into his face. It was so strong that it was difficult to breathe, so strong that he had to lean forward and drive with his legs to hold his own against it. As he hung on there, things began blowing past him, swept downward by the rush of air. Maple leaves in fall colors, red, gold, orange, shreds of paper, brown rose petals. Dead birds, sparrows and robins somersaulted limp-winged around his ears. Dropping lower to his belly, Doc crawled forward, pulling himself to the door jamb. When he reached over the jamb, he could no longer feel the floor. It ended on his side of the jamb. Before him, beyond the reach of the spotlight, was pitch darkness. After a moment, a pinpoint of brightness appeared in the center of the black, growing wider and wider, like the iris of a great eye opening. Doc choked on a flood of tears, certain that he was looking at the backside of the very same oculus that his daughter Rachel had glimpsed, November of 1896. glimpsed more than once, it couldn't forget. How it had frightened her. An eye hanging in space. God's eye, she had called it. At the time, Doc had been very concerned by the girl's reports. He had enough medical knowledge to realize that hallucinations were not always the result of an overactive, childish imagination. They could also be caused by tumors of the brain or poisons in the environment. He had no way of knowing that what Rachel had witnessed were tests of the time troll machinery from the distant future, a maw opening and closing. Through the iris, he could see bright gray, but it wasn't fog and it wasn't smoke. It didn't drip like a mist. It had no moisture to it. It didn't burn his nose and eyes. It held no choking ash. When he turned his head, the blur of gray moved with it. It seemed to be something internal, like his own vision was failing, clouding over with cataracts. More stuff was sucked or driven past him. A lady's hat, wide-brimmed with gray and white feathers. With a start, he recognized it as Emily's. Then came an open parasol. Doc avoided the trash can. Then something much larger shot by. Though he saw it only for a fraction of a second, the image stuck in his consciousness. It was the image of himself, sucked headlong down the churning tunnel. He saw the terror and disbelief in his own eyes, the long frock coat with small gold buttons, the diamond stick pin in his cravat, the hair, not yet streaked with gray, gone to a future that didn't want him, to a landscape of pain and regret. As he rose to his feet, Doc saw his little family standing huddled before him on the misty Omaha street. They were just as he remembered them. Emily holding their infant son, Julian. Rachel standing close to her.
My darlings. My dearest, most precious darlings.
Where's my daddy?
It's all right, Rachel. Daddy's here. He's back with you and safe.
No!
How do you know my daughter's name? Who are you? What do you want? Where's my husband? What have you done with him?
Wait, please.
Before Doc could frame an answer, Emily grabbed the little girl by the hand and, clutching Julian to her breast, took off in the opposite direction.
Police! Help! Police!
Wait, Emily, dearest. Emily, please. Please wait for me. Wait. Oh, my stomach. Please. No. No. No.
When he raised his head, Doc saw that nothing was as it seemed. He was in a Matrans chamber. Sitting on the floor across from him was Dr. Antoine Kirby. His tall top knot of dreads had completely flopped over to one side. Puke stained the lap of his BDU pants.
Oh, God, that was awful. Oh, gotta get some air. I'm gonna dry heave again. Oh.
Kirby crawled out of the unit. Doc looked around the chamber floor for his sword stick, then remembered that he'd lost it at Magus's redoubt. Without the help of the cane to get to his feet, Doc had to crawl out too. The gateway control room was one of the largest he'd ever seen. It had three times the normal number of workstations. One wall was made up of massive tape drive computers, and another wall was lined with what looked like power transformers and boosters. The air smelled of ozone and warm plastic. On the fourth wall were a pair of gasketed vanadium steel doors, side by side.
Are those gateways as well?
No, those are temporal transfer chambers.
Two of them?
You and I will be transferring simultaneously.
Why is that necessary?
It conserves energy. It takes a tremendous amount of power to get the system online. In fact, it will pretty much use up all the redoubt's nuclear reserves. We have to jump simultaneously. There won't be enough energy left for another power-up. When the system's operational energy level is reached, two jumps, perhaps even 100 jumps, are possible. If they take place in the same instant. There's another reason for simultaneous transfer, too. For us both to slip back into the same timeline, our jumps must be coordinated to a fraction of a nanosecond.
Doc couldn't help but notice that the mathematician's grief over the loss of his colleague seemed to be under control. On the verge of a great experiment, the culmination of a life's work, the salvation of the known world, there was much to occupy and distract Kirby's mind.
How do you know any of this for a fact?
It's It's not a fact. His predictions derived from our computer models of super time space.
Do your models tell you what we will experience when we go back in time?
No. That's something impossible to predict. We assume it will be similar to the Matt Trans experience. Disorientation, unconsciousness, vivid dreaming, nausea after the fact. What was it like when you traveled forward in time?
The lower depths of hell.
Well, we can hope for better than that.
Will I see myself?
Perhaps. Perhaps not. The door you're about to exit through is not the same one you were drawn into hundreds of years ago. It will be close, but the locations will not overlap.
What must I do?
All that's required is that you open the door and step out of the chamber. You won't be home until you leave it. You must exit within a minute or so of reaching the terminus.
Will my family even recognize me? I am older than when I left. The trolling has aged me, too.
Say you were struck by lightning.
I beg your pardon.
Sorry. Pretend to be gravely ill. As far as they're concerned, you won't have left at all. You will just have disappeared for a moment. Trust me, they'll accept you with open arms.
But I am different. It's going to be like stepping out of a room and returning a minute later scarred physically and perhaps mentally. My young Emily will suddenly be married to a 60-year-old man.
Your teeth are still fine.
For the first time, Tanner got the distinct impression that Dr. Kirby didn't care what happened to him, as long as he stepped out of the time chamber on cue. Perhaps that was understandable. It wasn't his problem.
I have a lot of preparations to make. It will take twice as long to set up the computers without Graydon's help. Why don't you go have a wash? The showers are through the door and down the hall to the right. There are some clean clothes laid out for you.
It was the first hot shower that Doc had had in a long time. Using plenty of soap and a small brush he found, he scrubbed out the ground in filth of Deathlands. When he toweled the steam off the mirror afterward and looked at himself, he decided that without the dirt, he looked even older. Late 60s, perhaps. The grime had plugged the seams in his face like pancake makeup. There was a light in his haggard face, though. He was to be released from prison after serving an unjust 200-year sentence. He thought better of changing his clothes. Appearing in a light blue Air Force-issue jumpsuit would have been yet another shock for his loved ones. He pulled on the threadbare coat and trousers, the worn, patched knee boots. When he returned to the control room, he saw that Kirby had washed and spruced up too. Gone were the massive dreads. He had shaved and waxed his head and discarded his Deathlands clothing. He wore a sparkling white lab coat. Clipped to the pocket was a plastic photo ID from Livermore Labs.
I'm still running system diagnostics. We have time to eat.
My last meal in Deathlands.
The redoubt is well stocked, equipped with sub-zero freezers. Government money paid for all of it. Our tax dollars at work. What's your pleasure, Dr. Tanner?
A well-aged T-bone steak, scalloped potatoes, steamed buttered asparagus, and an appropriate wine.
Been a long time, huh?
I have to admit, it has been a while.
Well, I can provide everything but the wine. Colonel Bell popped a bottle of pre-dark Cabernet Sauvignon after we came out of cryogenesis. There was stuff floating around in it that you wouldn't believe. The cork had failed. All the corks had failed. I do have some interesting scotch. 150 years mellow.
While the dinner was cooking itself, they drank liquid amber silk from crystal tumblers.
Ah. Here, let me top that off for you.
Are you trying to get me lubricated?
Relaxed. And I'm drinking as much as you. A Matt Trans and a time jump in the same day could be rough.
Is all that fine food I smell going to come back up afterwards?
Live for the moment, Tanner. Live for the moment.
Kirby raised his glass.
Here's to Colonel Graydon Bell.
To Colonel Bell and to my companions.
Salute!
Kirby then reached into his side pocket.
I have something I want you to take with you. It's more important than you can imagine. The survival of our world depends on it.
He put a tiny metal capsule and a neck chain onto Doc's open palm.
Inside the capsule is information that must fall into the hands of the heads of Operation Kronos before the time trawl is performed. You must find a way to ensure that this happens and that the contents remain intact.
I will do my best to honor that request.
Ah, the food's done. Here we are. Some steaks. And some asparagus. And the potatoes. The cheese didn't fare so well, so I hope you're fine with oil, pepper, and garlic.
I think I could stand that, yes.
Here we are. Two self-heating dinners. Should be pretty good, actually.
Doc was surrounded by the aromas. His mouth watered.
This is absolutely delightful.
Yeah, science can be pretty cool sometimes.
As they began to eat the food, Doc changed the subject to the trainers and their unique attributes and peculiarities.
How could such a creature have evolved on this Earth? Nothing about them makes sense.
Well, if they didn't come from here, then where?
Precisely. Rumor has it that Magus time travels.
Now, that's bullshit. He can't be jumping back and forth in time. STS says reality would fall to pieces.
Time is a dimension, correct?
Of course, the fourth dimension.
What if some other kind of dimensional travel is involved? Beyond the fourth, I mean. If there are four, might there not be 10 or 100?
Or a million.
If the travel in this case was between parallel universes, would there be catastrophic disruption to the current existence?
Well, there's no way to tell. Our experience with consequences of temporal transfer is limited to what happened to you. A single case. Certainly parallel universes have been predicted, theoretically.
Doc could verify those theories, but chose not to.
Is it conceivable that he could be looting parallel worlds and returning to this one?
No. The kind of dimensional travel you're talking about is impossible. No such technology existed prior to the apocalypse. And I seriously doubt it could have been developed since. There are fundamental, insurmountable problems. Even if Magus could move between universes, how would he ever find his way back? How would he know where he would end up when he stepped across? There's no up or down in what you're describing, just a vast other scape. We're not talking about a map of Georgia here. It's a random number crapshoot. One universe is just as likely to be next door at one moment as any other, and the consequences of travel would be just as destructive, bringing things into a timeline from elsewhere.
Else when?
Whatever. It would have the same destabilizing effect.
So, where did the trainers come from?
They could have come from outer space. That's an easier sell than parallel worlds. But it still doesn't speak to a larger issue.
Which is?
If Magus could go anywhere in a million universes, why would he come back to this hellhole, even for a visit?
Touché, Dr. Kirby. Why indeed?
It's time to get back to the control room. Under the circumstances, I think we'll leave the dishes.
Doc pushed up from his chair and fell in behind. Clearly, there were some things that Kirby wasn't taking into account. Doc had seen materiel from another world, seen beings from that world arrive here not once, but twice, with his own eyes. And despite that double intrusion, the fabric of existence seemed as whole as it ever had. None of Kirby's supposed disastrous effects had taken place. Perhaps it was a problem of specialization, Doc thought. When Doc had gone to university, that hadn't been an issue. But in the last part of the 20th century, whitecoats only worked in limited fields. They didn't know the rules or operating procedures of other disciplines, and moreover, they didn't give a damn. Perhaps if Colonel Bell had survived, Doc might have gotten a more satisfactory answer to his question about the trainers. Physicists, in his experience, were voluble and interesting conversationalists, less grounded in the purely rational than other whitecoats, freer, more liberal thinkers. Not that Kirby wasn't personable enough, but he was a mathematician by training and inclination. Somewhat tipsy from the whiskey, and sleepy from all the food, Doc felt a sudden rush of sentimentality. He was about to say goodbye to Deathlands after all these years. The actuality of his leaving had finally begun to sink in. It was no longer an abstract desire, a wistful longing. He was really going. Forever. He thought about the memories he would be taking back to Nebraska. Of the battles, of the dangers, of the triumphs, of Lori Quint. Truly, he was not the same man who was stolen away. He had changed into a hard-bitten warrior. Could he actually return to his own peaceful time, to domesticity, to academia? Could he live as he should have lived? Could he slip into the ease and safety of Victorian America, as if none of this had ever happened? To have seen so much death and suffering, to have caused death and suffering in order to survive, answering bullet for bullet, blade thrust for blade thrust. What kind of a father would such a man be in a world where violence was not a virtue, but the act of a psychopath, a serial criminal? Would he be the kind of father children would run from screaming? Doc slumped into a control room chair, feeling the full weight and sum of his years. Kirby tinkered with the computers, and gradually the room started to get very warm.
It won't be long now before we hit peak power. The grid is just coming online.
Doc let his gaze turn inward. Instead of joy, he felt excruciating pain over what he was about to give up. It was something he hadn't expected to feel at this moment, something he had to put aside.
What I have prayed for so long, I will humbly accept as God's true gift. The path that lies straight ahead is the path from which I will not waver.
Ryan had already made his decision. It was forced upon him by circumstances, a decision of last resort. The army of freebooters that had sailed south from Morro Bay had dwindled to 13 souls. 8 islanders, 5 companions. If the survivors of the Tanawati remained where they were, in the middle of the islet, the combined attacks of large and small foes were going to grind them into stew meat. Ryan had already learned that striking the skagworms with a sharp edge did nothing but dull the blade. The creature just acquired another target. Instead of rejoining the attack on him, it slithered off to assault an islander who was stopping a rat devil for pulp while two more chewed the backs of his calves.
Back to the beach! Egg! Into the water! We've got to get into the water!
You heard it, men! Fall back to the water!
They formed another flying wedge of sword and knife and tomahawk and fought their way through the stickies and swampies. There were fewer to deal with now, and the ones that remained seemed warier, a tad less suicidal. As they broke through the thin Muti ranks and charged for the shore, the uniforms in the boats stood and shouldered their auto rifles, but in a very relaxed, lackadaisical sort of way.
Ryan, what the rat blazes are you doing?
Just leveling the plane.
But the fuckers in the rowboats!
If they shoot, they shoot. Would you rather check out from a bullet or die with a sticky peeling off your face?
Well, shit. Are those my choices?
Deeper! Wait up, deeper!
The 13 survivors trudged out until the water came up to their hips. Then they turned toward shore to face the coming onslaught. The fastest and most agile of their pursuers jumped into the water after them. The rat devils could swim all right. They dog-paddled, their heads held above water, little legs kicking. But they swam in straight lines at a tenth of their speed on land, and they couldn't jump around to evade the falling blades. No one needed instructions on what to do next. The islanders hacked and whacked the surface-swimming rat devils. The glancing blows stunned them. The well-aimed swings bisected them. Their toy poodle-sized bodies drifted by, staining the water a deep red. The skagworms reached the finish line next. A half dozen of them snaked right up to the waterline, but stopped short of getting their 1,000 or so feet wet. They either could no longer sense the presence of their prey, or they refused to enter the water to chase it. Swampies had a problem with the water, too. They were smart enough to see that if they waded out far enough to reach the norms, they would be submerged to their armpits, which meant they couldn't swing their clubs and swords with any power. Not being able to finish the job they started made the ankle biters furious. They smashed their weapons into the shallows, pounding the water to a froth. The stickies were the immediate concern. Water didn't bother them, and once they had regrouped and gotten their numbers up, they seemed to have rediscovered their zeal for the hunt. As with the others, the stickies were dealt with more easily in the water than on land. The islanders slaughtered them like pigs, with sword sweeps that practically cut them in two. Everyone got their licks in. JB with his tomahawk, Jack, Mildred, and Christy with their blades. Again and again, Ryan's Ponga cleaved soft skulls down to the nose holes. Muti gore spread in a thin, greasy film on the water's surface. Stickies and parts of stickies drifted away in a swath of blood. Seeing the futility of attack, a few of the bald muties actually managed to hold themselves back, although with great difficulty. They hopped around wildly behind the irate swampies on the shore.
Christy! Look out! Wazzy! Yeah.
Christy ducked her head as the lizard bird swept over her. After the close call she'd had a few minutes ago, it was impossible not to flinch. The Wazzy reversed course and joined its sole surviving partner above the middle of the islet. The pair began to fly in tight spirals, trying desperately to gain altitude. With their torn wings, they could only climb to 60 or 70 feet. A scaly, its head shrouded in clouds of stinging black flies, blundered blindly toward the water, its flabby arms outstretched. The other mutie stepped aside and let the behemoth pass. It threw itself into the water, submerging in an attempt to drive off the tiny but lethal attackers. It wasn't a bad idea, but it had come a little too late. The mutie popped up like a dead whale, face down, spread-eagled. Christy hadn't seen the five blonde girls as they stepped out of the doorway. She was looking at the birds. When she glanced down, the wraiths were already descending into the amphitheater. Christy would have laughed at the sight of them, but she knew the kind of jokes Magus played weren't funny to anyone but him. They looked like sisters, quintuplets, identical heights, tall and willowy, with perfect snow-white faces. The young girls glided over the littered battlefield, the long hems of their white gowns dragging through the carnage, their thin arms folded under their breasts, like they were crossing a ballroom at a baron's wedding feast. To Christy, there was something odd about the way they moved and held themselves so erect, something unnatural. They walked directly under the desperately flapping birds and raised their heads. When the girls opened their mouths, Christy saw they were black inside. The huge birds dropped out of the sky as if hit by cannon shot, one instant flying, the next falling in a heap. The lizard birds died thrashing on the rocks. The odor of cooked lizard meat wafted across the islet. The wraiths moved on deliberately, but without haste, as if they had all the time in the world, as if they were in total command. A few of the scalies still hunkered over their human victims. They saw the girls coming out of the corners of their eyes, but waited too long to get to their feet. After they had risen from their haunches, they realized they couldn't move fast enough to escape. Black mouths opened in unison. The scalies clustered together, dropping to their knees. Christy saw their eyes burst. Then what had to be liquid brains started running out their noses. The blonde teenagers weren't done yet, though. They glided closer. The scaly skins began to delaminate. Between the layers of tissue on their sagging chests and backs, air pockets formed, then expanded as intense heat turned trapped juices to steam. As on a well-roasted turkey, great voids appeared under the skin, translucent bubbles glistening with fat. The water closest to the girls started to steam, and ripples extended out from the shore.
What the hell are they?
A mutie cleanup squad. They're coming for us and taking out everything in between.